Coming up. Gaslighter, denier,
repeating all of the mistakes of your father. With so much disinformation out there, how can we run a democracy together?
Beating the drum over and over on their version of events, their version, it's gaslighting.
Why has the U.S. become so polarized?
He suggested that it was less dangerous than the flu. Not true. He claimed it was well under control. Not true.
Anti-vaxxers, QAnon devotees, 9/11 truthers.
Should people this deluded really be reporting the news or holding elected office? You're such a gaslighter,
denier. It's beyond gaslighting. It's something different.
Is there a vaccine for the disinformation pandemic?
Our guest is attorney and Emmy-nominated analyst Dean Johnson.
Disinformation and the future of democracy.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. In a world of disinformation, can anyone make informed political decisions?
Anti-vaxxers, QAnon devotees, 9/11 truthers. How out of touch can America get?
How can we come together as a nation if we can't even agree on what's true?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm John Perry, sitting in for Josh Landy. We're coming to you from our respective living room via the studios of KELW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and John did for 50 years. Thanks for coming back to co-host with me today, John.
Honored to do it. Nothing but pleasure.
Today we're thinking about disinformation and the future of democracy.
It looks to me that until we do a better job cracking down on disinformation, democracy is pretty hopeless.
No, come on, John. Democracy just means that everybody gets a vote. What does that even have to do with disinformation?
Well, yeah, democracy is not just about voting, though. It won't work unless the voting's intelligent, based on meaningful decisions about who runs things and how. You can't make a meaningful decision if you don't know what's going on.
Okay, fine. I hate dishonesty as much as the next person, but you can't just silence people. I mean, that's against free speech.
Yeah, unfortunately. Free speech means you can say whatever you want. But no one has to circulate it. No one has to broadcast it. No one has to pin it to their bulletin board. And you can be held responsible for the effects of what your speech does to people when they hear it. These days, social media companies just let people lie with impunity. Somebody might do something.
Well, I mean, who do you want to do something? The government? I mean, do you really want politicians to have power over what people say in the public square?
No, not the government. That's what the First Amendment says. Government can't do it. But if I have a grocery store with a bulletin board and somebody puts a Nazi insignia on there or something like that, I have the right to take it down. And the same goes for the social media platforms. They have a responsibility and a right to take down blatant lies and misinformation, and it's not illegal for them to do it.
Yeah, but like, do they know the difference? And even if they know, do you think they care? I mean, their whole purpose is just to reinforce things that people already believe. They just want more eyeballs, more clicks, more advertising revenue.
Well, maybe social media platforms don't care, but they should. I think some of them do. If they don't, then we should create one that does.
Well, yeah, but who's going to make them care?
Well, the universities that educated them in the first place, it's a democracy. So ultimately, the people have to make them care.
But the people are living in a disinformation bubble. And how can they do anything if they're misinformed?
Well, a lot of the time, they do know that they're misinformed, and they willfully ignore it. If you only read things you already believe, and then share those articles without fact-checking them, that's your fault, and you need to do better.
Yeah, but not everybody has a philosophy education, John. I mean, you're just expecting too much of people.
People aren't going to get educated if we don't have a functioning democracy. And we don't have a functioning democracy unless we have educated citizens to make it work. That's why I said a while ago, it seems pretty hopeless unless we can do something about disinformation.
Well, look, maybe our guest has some ideas. Dean Johnson, an attorney and a political analyst who's also the founder of the Pundit Network. We talked to him last year on Your Legal Rights, the weekly show he co-hosts on KALW. And this time he's joining us on Philosophy Talk.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDean, to find out what happened in one California city when a controversial website filled the news and information void. She files this report.
If you're a mayor promising to give residents free money, there is a chance a filmmaker will want to make a documentary about you.
The Stockton story is this idea of redemption, taking what was bad and trying to make it good.
Good morning. You need Band-Aids or anything?
People get it. They're excited. They've never had a mayor like this before.
The film Stockton on My Mind is about the city's former mayor, Michael Tubbs. In 2016, when he was just 26, he was elected by over 70% of the vote. He became Stockton's youngest and first African-American mayor, and he got a lot of attention for pushing for universal basic income.
The issues we're trying to solve, mainly violent crime, poverty, and housing and homelessness, it's going to take more creativity and more collaboration. And also more of a willingness to take some risk.
Stockton is one of the most racially diverse cities in the country. A quarter of people who live there also live in poverty. Under the Universal Basic Income Program, 125 Stockton residents were given $500 a month with no strings attached.
These are programs that didn't cost a dime for the city.
Rich Ibarra is a correspondent with Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. He says some people were still critical about universal basic income.
There was maybe a mistrust of people maybe getting a hand out instead of a hand up.
The guaranteed income idea has its opponents, conservatives against government handouts, and labor unions who want well-paid jobs, not small payments with no opportunity for advancement.
And local news was struggling. Stockton's newspaper, The Record, had been decimated by layoffs and declining subscriptions.
What you might call a skeleton crew. And in that respect, too, their deadline is like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So often, if something happens in the evening, you won't see it until 2 days later.
Enter 209 Times, an online news blog launched by a local activist who ran against Tubbs.
Even the publisher, if you call it a blog, said he was out to get Michael Tubbs.
At one point, the site posted a meme depicting Tubbs as a crack addict. In another, he's drinking a martini. One story said he had a secret plan to run a regional homeless hub. It also spread misinformation that he was misspending $60 million meant to address homelessness.
Stockton never got $60 million. He got $6 million, but not $60 million.
By the time Tubbs ran for re-election in 2020, 209 Times had nearly 100,000 followers on Facebook and 120,000 on Instagram. He lost the race and believes the misinformation spread by the site is a big reason why. But Rich Ibarra says Tubbs also didn't do much to respond to the misinformation as it spread.
As to how much he would have been able to correct anyway without his own blog or his own internet situation, it's hard to say.
And the 209 Times blog now has some competition. In late 2020, a local historian decided he'd like to start a new site too. So he did. It's called Stocktonia. And once again, readers must decide who to trust.
One person's fake news is another person's news.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that informative report, Holly. I'm Ray Briggs. And with me today is my Stanford colleague and host emeritus, John Perry. We're thinking about disinformation and the future of democracy.
We're joined now by Dean Johnson. He's a criminal defense attorney in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst, and he's co-host of Your Legal Rights on KALW. Dean, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Dean, you've been a criminal attorney for decades. But in the last few years, you've become really interested in First Amendment issues. How did that happen?
Well, my interest in First Amendment goes back a long way. I'm 70 years old right now. When I was 16, I started marching in civil rights demonstrations in the segregated South. I've written extensively on First Amendment issues throughout graduate school and law school. And in the last 15 years, in addition to practicing law, I've also been a working journalist. So I learned that side of free speech, the freedom of the press side. I've learned how to invoke the reporter's shield law, how to litigate my right to get into courtrooms, and also how to protect confidential sources. So it's been a lifelong pursuit for me.
You know, we may have met in the March on the Pentagon around 1968. Were you there?
You know, I believe I was.
Yeah, we might have run into each other. I drove all the way down from Ithaca and tried hard to get arrested so I wouldn't have to drive back the same day, but I couldn't get it done.
So, Dean, the spread of disinformation, now that's not exactly a new phenomenon, but right now there are some sources of disinformation that seem really worrying. Will you tell us about some of those?
Sure. Yeah, disinformation has been around for a long time. The old-fashioned term we used for it is propaganda. But what's concerning now is the depth and breadth of disinformation aided and abetted by media and by new technology, and particularly by social media. I mean, what we find is that social media has been set up in such a way so that anyone can get access and can publish on social media. Ideas that used to be outliers and, you know, ideas of extremists that were confined to people who were living in their mother's basement are now posted to millions of people. And social media, probably not deliberately, was set up so that its algorithms work to reinforce and amplify people's confirmation bias. If you hear something or see something on social media that you really like, you get more and more and more of that information. And what this has led to is a kind of what I call cognitive tribalism, that people are now living in separate silos where they hear only the kind of information that they want to hear. And only the kind of information that confirms their own preconceived notions of how the world works. And a lot of times they get hooked into listening to and watching things that simply aren't true, or getting their information from sources that don't have their best interest at heart. And that is a huge problem, as we all learned in very dramatic fashion on January 6th.
So social media wasn't really designed to be a news source, but it seems to be functioning that way for a lot of people. Like, how do we understand this, like, co-option of social media as a place where people get their news?
It's a huge problem. It used to be, you know, back in the day when I was marching in civil rights movements, there were very limited news sources that everybody watched the 6 o'clock news, and the reports on all three networks were about the same. Now, if anything, there's a problem of too much access. A news source can be something that's reputable or something that's totally disreputable or something that even has evil intention. And people who listen really haven't been armed with the kind of critical faculties and judgment tools that they need to evaluate, you know, what's true and what's false. And they get hooked into things that count as news that really aren't news. And the net result is that we have people who now live in what some of us describe as an alternative universe. They believe in a timeline that's never really happened. They see and interpret events in ways that are contrafactual. And the unfortunate part of that is that the kind of cognitive tribalism we're seeing now overlaps with political views, with religious views, even with geographical location, with red state and blue state, with urban and rural, and so on and so forth. And it creates lines of division that overlap. And it's almost a perfect storm for social division and ultimately social chaos.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about disinformation and democracy with attorney and political analyst Dean Johnson.
What happens when our media environment makes it hard to tell the difference between truth and lies? How can we keep our integrity as thinkers and citizens? Can a free society survive an onslaught of fake news?
Clickbait, bullcrap, and outright lies. But also, your comments and questions. When Philosophy Talk continues. Just when I need another point of view, here you come from nowhere, from over the waves.
I stand amazed, I see your greatest hits, they blow back down the chimney into everyone's eyes.
How can democracy function with so many people spinning so much disinformation? I'm Ray Briggs. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry, sitting in for Josh Landy, and we're thinking about disinformation and the future of democracy with attorney and legal analyst Dean Johnson.
We've had good information on the pandemic, so we're pre-recording this episode from the safety of our respective homes, and we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us comments at philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Dean, you've told us what you think are the most worrying kinds of disinformation. Do these new sources of disinformation pose greater threats to democracy than they have in the past?
Oh, there's no question about it. What we were concerned about in the old days was that for their own interests, people in power might distort the occasional fact, might provide funding to elect a certain candidate. But what we see now is that disinformation is produced and consumed not just on a daily basis or an hourly basis, but on a second-by-second basis. If you look at, say, social media and you have any friends who are from red states, who are part of the what's come to be called the Trump base, you will see post after post after post, minute after minute, of things that are simply untrue or, more importantly, things that distort a worldview. And it's not so much misrepresentation of facts. It's this pervasive effort to change the way that people see and interpret and evaluate facts and the meaning that they attach to facts. One of the iconic examples for me were the pictures that were circulated around Inauguration Day. And they were pictures that were taken through a chain link fence of the United States Capitol. And of course, those chain link fences were there to prevent another January 6th insurrection. And that's the way I saw it. And that's the way many other people saw it. But people out there in the red states saw it very differently. And they posted captions saying, "This is what a dictator does. He has to put a fence and armed guards around his own inauguration." And that's the way they saw it, because, of course, the way in their world, Joe Biden had staged a coup d'etat, had stolen the Democratic election, and was an illegitimate president. So it becomes a day-to-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute worldview where people interpret, not only get information that's contrafactual, but they interpret facts in a way that is framed by an ideology that simply isn't true.
So I agree that this is really worrisome, both the alternative facts that are false and the alternative interpretations of true facts. Earlier, you linked that to social media. And I was wondering how that connects to like a thing that I think is good about social media, but also worrisomely linked to disinformation. So social media, you mentioned, makes it so that anybody can have a voice. Like, you don't have to be one of three news outlets.
Right.
And you might think that's like great and democratizing and has amazing potential, but its potential is not getting used. Like, is it worrisome precisely because it's democratizing, or is the problem orthogonal to like the centrality versus non-centrality?
Well, you know, if you go back and look at the very beginnings of social media, Those of us who were advocates for free speech thought that this was a tremendous opportunity for democracy. And in some ways, social media has fulfilled that prophecy. If we look back at Arab Spring, for example, the demonstrations, the protests against dictatorships throughout the Middle East were fueled by social media. But the internet and social media are like are tools, and they're like anything else. They can be used for good purposes or for bad purposes. And what we haven't realized, the unintended consequence of social media and unlimited access is that those people with bad intentions or people who are simply misguided also, instead of being dismissed as outliers and extremists, now rapidly gain audiences. And that's the problem that we as a society have to deal with, and we haven't dealt with it yet. I actually developed a prototype social media called Pundit Network, which is still online. And what we learned, I developed it as part of an undergraduate class in media politics and society. And what we learned from that is that social media actually can be modeled in such a way that it fulfills that democratic process. There's a thing called the wisdom of the crowds, and social media by definition reaches a crowd. If you can use your social media utility to tap into that wisdom of the crowds, then social media becomes an instrument for generating truth. And one of the things that we know about people who participate in that particular kind of social media is that they become more informed, better informed. They learn to look at multiple perspectives and critically evaluate those perspectives, and they become more engaged as citizens of a democracy. So it is possible, but right now they can't do it.
So this is helpful on kind of partly the consumption side. I also am curious about the production side and how much of that is less democratic than it appears. There was that kind of Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that was just all these sort of people who are being paid to sort of write clickbaity articles where truth was usually irrelevant. So it seems like if you have a society of people who are all kind of exercising their due diligence in producing news and trying to do journalism on Twitter, which I know a lot of people do, then you can have a really truth-tracking society. But then if you have some people who are getting money from somebody who doesn't particularly care about anybody having true beliefs and just has orthogonal desires to that, or even at odds desires to that. Is my question making sense?
I understand totally what you're saying. In fact, I sometimes monitor contacts that I have from my youth growing up in the South, people who are still in the red states, still part of the Trump base, and I look at what they look at and what they post. And you can see trends. Following the Biden inauguration, I saw an immediate trend in those people getting posts that support the oil industry and opposed, say, shutting down Keystone XL, talking about how Joe Biden's policies would raise the price of oil and so on. And you can understand, given Biden's articulated policies against or in favor of regulations that would prevent climate change, in favor of alternative energies, you can understand how certain corporate powers would have an interest in steering all of that commentary towards things that are of interest to, say, the oil industry. I don't know that there's anything that one can do about it. I mean, the Citizens United ruling is a huge problem. And I don't know that you can tell corporations that they don't have First Amendment rights. But what you can do is provide alternative outlets for people who don't want to hear that and who want to look at a social media network that devotes itself to evidence-based, reliable forecasting and information, that has a search engine that doesn't select based on ideology but searches for all points of view. Pundit Network was our attempt to do that, and it worked. I don't suggest that that's a global solution, but that's a small part of the solution.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about disinformation and democracy with attorney and political analyst Dean Johnson.
You know, I've been a member of the ACLU since, I don't know, I could talk. And for a long time, you know, you could be an extremist about freedom of speech, but the Constitution protects freedom of speech from the government, the federal government originally, and then the states after Civil War, at least that's how I understand it. It doesn't protect you from the consequences of your freedom of speech, and it doesn't protect people who publish it and distribute it from the consequences of distributing misinformation and slander. At least it didn't until a law passed a little while ago by the Congress, who somebody here probably remembers the name of, that does kind of insulate Facebook and Twitter from being sued or held legally responsible for the bad effects of passing on misinformation. And I think that's something that those of us who are lifelong freedom of speech advocates and didn't really worry that that could lead to any harm need to take account. We have to have a more subtle understanding, or not necessarily all that subtle, about exactly who it prevents from doing what. And it certainly doesn't prevent me from tearing down a swastika that somebody's put on the tree in my front yard. And I don't think it prevents Mark Zuckerberg from exercising some standards based on his understanding of the world with Facebook, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, John, you know, that raises a number of issues. I mean, what you're talking about is Section 230 of the Computer Decency Act, which was one of the first legislative responses to the whole phenomenon of social media. And what underlies Section 230 is a kind of a naive notion about social media, that they're simply a neutral conduit for information, and that all of us can observe social media and observe information through this conduit and evaluate information for ourselves. But as Marshall McLuhan said back in the 60s, the medium is sometimes the message. And that's particularly true with social media, in that social media operates on algorithms that select what you see and hear. And that's a problem. And what's going on now is that the legislatures are beginning to reconceptualize social media and see that social media are not just neutral conduits, but they take an active role in deciding what sort of content you see. And the solution that's been suggested is that we allow the people who operate social media, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, to decide actively what goes through their social media. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not any more comfortable with having Mark Zuckerberg decide what I see and hear than I am with having the government decide. And one of the great dangers is if Mark Zuckerberg or Facebook or any of the big social media companies become the decision makers about what gets transmitted to other people, they run the risk of having their actions be deemed state action. That in effect, we could see a legal precedent that says, okay, social media is the modern public square. It's performing a government function. So,
well, maybe that's a possibility, but intelligent people should make sure it doesn't happen. I mean, Life magazine, Look magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, they had the duty to decide what got published on their pages, and no one thought that they didn't have the responsibility for doing that. That is, they didn't have to pay the price, whatever it might take, if they did a crappy job of that. And we're not going to make it so that even if we multiply the number of social media companies, the people who own them and operate them will be deciding whether it's a good thing or bad. But the worst thing is to have them decide and then say, but you're not responsible for the effects of your decisions.
So the one area where social media companies are now legally liable for what is published on them has not gone great, I would say. So they are legally liable now for things that could be construed as sex trafficking, which is not very well or clearly defined. I'm opining here, and you can correct me if you think I'm overstepping. And so how this works in practice is that a lot of social media companies, like I think Tumblr is a good example, have just suppressed all speech that relates to sex, whether it's like educational or whether it's like sex workers sharing information to stay safe as though it were sex trafficking. So I don't really trust making social media companies liable for what's published on them necessarily as a solution, unless we've got a better idea of what kinds of harm they're supposed to be liable for.
Yeah, it becomes extremely problematic to have somebody make judgments about the content of speech. The traditional free speech jurisprudence is that where content is concerned, we don't allow the government to make judgments, and we don't really allow anybody else to make judgments. I think the consequences of speech are difficult to predict, and you cannot regulate speech and regulate it in order to prevent adverse consequences without making value judgments as opposed to scientific judgments about the content of speech.
Yeah, but there's and a...
So that's something that we don't want to do.
There's a non sequitur there. You say, so we don't allow the government to inhibit free speech. Right. And then you say, and so nobody else should either. Well, the Catholic Church shouldn't inhibit free speech in its Marinol newsletter. I mean, if I'm running a social media company and there's a law passed that means I'll be in serious trouble if I publicize, child molestation videos and instructions for how to do it, I may decide, well, okay, that's probably a good law, but I just don't want to deal with this, so I'm not going to put any sex on my thing. That's free enterprise. That's reasonable.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about disinformation and the future of democracy with criminal defense attorney and co-host of KALW's Your Legal Rights, Dean Johnson.
Does disinformation have to spell the end of democracy? Or can we stem the tide of fake news? What will it take to repair our social institutions?
Dealing with disinformation, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. We're pretty sure the problem of disinformation is more than just a problem of too much information. I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry. Our guest is attorney and political analyst Dean Johnson, and we're thinking about disinformation and the future of democracy.
So, Dean, we've got an email from Raphael in Berkeley.
Okay.
Raphael writes, most people are not just passive consumers of information, but instead they come to the news with preconceived biases. To what extent are misinformation campaigns aided by an audience that wants to be misinformed, or at least that wants to have its views confirmed?
Well, there's always confirmation bias. And, disinformation would not be such a huge problem if it hadn't found really fertile ground in millions, possibly tens of millions of people who are looking for a different explanation for their own situations. We find that there are a lot of people who are in red states, who were responsive to Donald Trump's message, who are responsive to Fox News's message and to that sort of worldview. They're responsive to that because of the situations they find themselves in. They have considered themselves to be part of an entitled demographic that's losing its grasp on power. And a lot of what's said by somebody like Donald Trump, somebody or people like Fox News, strikes a resonating chord with them. And social media not only strikes that chord, but it reinforces that chord. There's a phenomenon called confirmation bias, where people only listen to and believe that which confirms their own preconceived notions. In social media, there's an algorithm that simply sends you stuff that does confirm your preconceived notions. So social media is almost like an amplifier or a reinforcer of what people already want to believe. And it just makes those preconceived notions stronger and more pervasive.
So this brings me to a kind of big philosophical worry that I have about this stuff, which is, so on the one hand, I want to insist on personal responsibility of news consumers, not just to believe whatever's put in front of them. And on the other hand, that seems like a completely inadequate answer to a structural problem. It's not just about any one individual. Like, where should we start?
I think it depends upon who your audience is. As I mentioned, I still correspond with and have close relations with people that I left in my high school days, who never moved out of red states, who became part of the Trump base. And it really depends on where they're at. A lot of people are still open to factual arguments. And if you can produce good facts, you can crack that conceptual framework. Unfortunately, there are also people who've evolved to the point where they are so locked into that worldview that it becomes non-falsifiable. If you indicate, okay, you just said something that is factually untrue, here are the real facts, the response will be, oh, well, that's exactly what somebody out on the left in California would say. Or your sources must be all fake news. So it simply becomes impossible to falsify their worldview or to crack through that conceptual framework. And what I've found in dealing with people like that is that a useful thing to do is to get into their own conceptual framework and start pointing out contradictions in their own worldview. For example, I like to suggest that, you know, they're opposed, people like this are generally opposed to universal health care, but also opposed to reproductive freedom. And in favor of what they would refer to as a right to life. And I point out that universal health care, countries that have universal health care generally have, in fact, infallibly have lower infant mortality rates. So to the extent that you are supporting, you're opposing universal health care, you're also supporting the death of children to the tune of hundreds and thousands of kids.
So Dan in Portland, Oregon has a worry that speaks to this, I think. So Dan is worried that rich people use alternative facts as a distraction from policies that would otherwise be really popular, like not letting people be plunged into debt by medical expenses, which kind of directly relates to your universal healthcare point. Mm-hmm. And so Dan asks, why not cut the private sector elites out of the equation altogether so that democratic power moves into the workplace and political power is replaced by labor?
I have to say I'm sympathetic with the idea, but I don't see it as a workable solution anywhere in the near future.
I think we agree on that.
So what about sort of our responsibilities as consumers of news? So one thing that I like to do, maybe because I'm a little bit pedantic, is when my friends are sending around articles on social media that seem badly substantiated, to complain and to say, like, this doesn't seem true, and to just hold others accountable, like at an individual level.
Well, that's become sort of a hobby of mine. I think we just need to keep the dialogue going. If there are people that you disagree with, if there are people out there that have a worldview that's different from yours, fact check them. One of the things that I remember most is that one of my colleagues who is from a very red state and very, very deeply into the whole Trump base and that sort of ideology produced posted a picture of a Nazi prison guard on social media and said, this is what George Soros was doing during World War II.
Yeah.
And I did about a 5 second fact check and pointed out that the picture was actually a picture of a Nazi stormtrooper who served as a guard at Auschwitz, and his name is well known. He was tried at Nuremberg, and that it could not be George Soros for the following reasons. First of all, George Soros is Jewish. He would not have been admitted into the Nazi party.
I thought that was people's problem with him, was that he was Jewish.
His family fled his native Hungary to escape Nazism, and he was 13 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And then I went on to point out that George Soros has been one of the great forces for a democratic revolution, particularly in the former Soviet Union, and both a student of Karl Popper, who was one of the great critics of totalitarianism and Nazism, and himself a critic of authoritarianism. I don't know if that made a dent or not, but you just keep trying.
So, Dean, I have one more quick question.
Sure.
Which is, so some disinformation proceeds by claiming things that aren't true, but other disinformation sort of proceeds by undermining. So, like, is it possible that Democrats are maybe kidnapping children? Mm-hmm. So those kinds of, like, just asking questions. Is there a special way to address the undermining kind of disinformation?
Yeah, I address it with facts. I actually had a client who believed that whole Hillary Clinton is running a child molesting ring out of the basement of the Comet Pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Oh, jeez.
And so he actually tried to kidnap his own children and take them away. He was separated from his wife and she had custody, wound up in a wild car chase with the police. And I pointed out to him when he came into custody and told me about Pizzagate that it was impossible for Hillary Clinton to be running a child molestation ring out of the basement of the Comet Pizza restaurant because the Comet Pizza restaurant does not have a basement. A fact that was later confirmed by a gentleman who drove carrying automatic weapons from North Carolina to Washington, D.C., walked into the Comet Pizza restaurant and demanded to see the basement and was told there was no basement and said, okay, never mind. as it turns out, my client wasn't crazy. He was just ahead of his time. But the way to deal with that is to respond with facts. Yeah, it's an old journalist trick and an old politician's trick to ask those questions and leave somebody to have to respond to the questions. But that's the only way to deal with it is with demonstrable facts.
I think that's a good note to go out on, just leaning on demonstrable facts. So, Dean, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Our guest has been Dean Johnson, who's a criminal defense attorney in the San Francisco Bay Area and co-host of Your Legal Rights, which you can hear Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. on KALW. So, John, what are you thinking now?
What am I thinking now? Actually, it all brings me back to a time a long time ago in the 70s, you know, early 80s, when I was a resident fellow in Stanford dorms, and we had a lot of racial stuff. People putting stuff up on bulletin boards, throwing stuff on people's doors, and even when Black kids would show up at orientation, calling them names. I just thought it was terrible. And I happened to be chairman of a committee that looked over Stanford's adherence to Senator Stanford's rules, which was that every Stanford student should conduct themselves as a gentleman or gentlewoman on or off campus, period. That's it. That's the honor code. That's all there is. And we thought that given that, it made sense to discipline people who did these things. But the official university response was, that would be inhibiting freedom of speech. And I made the case that, well, yes, that would be the university inhibiting freedom of speech. It wouldn't be any government inhibiting freedom of speech. And I ended up in a debate in a law school with some intelligent guy, probably would have been on the Supreme Court, except the Democrats didn't get back in office. And he said, Professor Ferry should worry about philosophy and leave the law to us. And I've never gotten over the feeling that I was right. It doesn't make sense for Stanford University to not at least take people out of their dorm and put them in a less nice dorm if they scrawl the N-word on some Black student's door. That has nothing to do with what we've been talking about, but I feel better getting it off my chest.
We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
If you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and you may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man who can talk faster than disinformation spreads. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, boy, that Trump era ended quick. Now things are moving forward to be torn down immediately because Mitch McConnell or the cancel culture says no. It's the same old new normal, only more fraught. Conservatives want to go back to a golden time when what was what, and we knew it. Of course, that's always been, as the woke say, problematic. The role of Jews and Black people in creating our popular culture is either celebrated or feared, while the Scandinavians in our midst cling to their bleak mysteries and hope that that, and saunas, will keep them in the viability column of the West culture-wise. What is that culture? White supremacy? Democracy? Both? Conservatives say they have no culture to be a part of. Well, ballet, opera, Shakespeare, and Broadway theater, symphony, ballroom dancing, reality television, professional sports, hunting, fishing, horse racing, yacht racing, country fairs, state fairs, car races, zoos, guns, casinos, fireworks displays, and more. They all seem to be squarely in the province of conservative values. Still, opera buffs are old and fading. The young have no interest unless it's with Bugs and Elmer Fudd. Plus, there's a sudden aversion to spending money on anything except wellness. And true, a sober-sided plutocrat approach to news is gone. The hippies at CBS ruined it. We have Fox because Pat Buchanan hates Dan Rather. And what happened to Pat Buchanan? All under siege from woke political correctness. So now comes the anti-woke cancel culture of the cancel culture. Finally, after years of Pat Buchanan, they finally got a Trump in there and they got so tickled with learning libs, they forgot what they wanted. They got the media running in so many circles, nobody could think straight. All the things people had been muttering for 30 years began to be loudly slurred drunkenly at chaotic backyard barbecues, and before you know it, QAnon. Which is what happens when Japanese tentacle porn hooks up with a young Republican, allegedly. Kiss that crew cut goodbye is all I'm saying. It is not coming back. That's why woke canceled Pepe Le Pew, why a couple of Dr. Seuss books won't be reprinted, why Potato Heads lost their manhood. We're banning the crew cut, America. If we ever have Easter parades again, you can bet fabulous transvestites will be hurling flaming batons at it. That's the hope. That's the fear. On the other hand, Antifa has proven to be a grave disappointment to the elders of Zion. And when it comes to power, who has the weapons? Who stormed the Capitol? Not very woke, was it? One of the big things around which angry opinions swirl is transgender world, the new alternative reality in which we all dwell. Caitlyn Jenner and Elliot Page have done their part to normalize transgender recently by having photographs taken of them. Caitlyn looks like a Republican senator's second wife, very classy. Elliot looks like the guy your sister would swoon over if you were 12, and you would make fun of her by kissing his picture and then feel kind of funny way down on your tummy. Seek therapy, pray. So, in other words, things are getting back to new normal in Smallville. Thwarted desire is the new normalized. Had shot two. I'm COVID-free now. Thanks, America, for the long lockdown punctuated by Trumpy jabbering. Then a long line and a cold day in the rain. And at the end of it all, a shot in the arm. Can we agree not to go through this again? By which I mean, can conservatives shut their pie holes and go along with something for a damn minute? I know it's hard. I feel the same way myself. But put on the mask on your gut. Get the damn shot. Kiss the pipeline goodbye. Keep those cattle off Mount Rushmore. Not too much to ask. Quit whining. Either take the government money and shut up or not take it. And also shut up. Set the rumor straight. The Biden dog did not kill anybody. The situation at the border is just a false flag disguised as the piñata. Smash it at your peril. Hunter Biden is a painter now, and because he's been in seclusion against the onslaught of conservative slings and arrows, he's become quite good. A major showing is in the works, which will knock the art world in its ears, selling his work for record prices, greater even than Beeple's. And if you don't know what that means, how can you even call yourself a conservative? How can you even call yourself woke? You wouldn't know a culture war if it bit you. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Bam is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
What does he mean when he says words?
I know words. I have the best words.